Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Panier, host of the Mejlis and author of the weekly Central Asia in Focus newsletter. How do Kyrgyz politicians and influential figures portray themselves as defenders of the people in Kyrgyzstan's, quote, sacred land, unquote, and yet exploit natural resources and cause severe environmental damage at the expense of local communities? This is the topic of a recent report from the Oxus Society entitled Resource Nationalism and Slow Violence in Kyrgyzstan. As Kyrgyzstan prepares to mark the 25th anniversary of the cyanide spill near the Kumtor gold mine that led to the deaths of several people and temporary evacuation of thousands of other people, we take a look at how Kyrgyz authorities continue to practice resource nationalism and the forms of violence that accompany it. To discuss all this, I am joined by the authors of the report. Baril Ojakli, who leads the research project China, the EU, and Economic Development in East Europe and Eurasia at the Center for East European and International Studies, COIS, in Berlin. As a critical geographer, she studies infrastructures, resource extractivism, society-nature relations, and authoritarian repression in Central Asia and South Caucasus. Previously, Baril led transdisciplinary development projects on resource governance and on behalf of the German government, the EU, and multilateral organizations. And Vincent Artmann, adjunct professor of geography and peace and conflict studies at Wayne State University in Detroit and the University of Delaware. His work has previously focused on Central Asia, specifically on religion, identity, and nationalism in Kyrgyzstan. Thank you both for being here and joining me today for this discussion. And I'm going to start with you, Vincent. Could you please, for our audience, describe first what the concept of resource nationalism is?
Sure. Thank you for having me today. Resource nationalism is, kind of an emerging field of study. In the past, it's often been linked with the notion of controlling natural resources by states, so ensuring that the government of Kyrgyzstan controls gold resources, or that Venezuela controls its oil resources, these sorts of things. But there's been some recent work in the discipline of geography, in particular, and I think in our paper we cite an article by Natalie Cook and Tom Perot that I think is a real keystone article here, that looks at resources as sort of an idiom through which national identity is understood and debated. And I think both in that article and our report, the idea of resources goes a little bit beyond simply things like oil or gold, although clearly, these kinds of things are quite important, but can also look at things like the natural environment of a particular country and the people's connection to it. How does, for example, the Kyrgyz nation, however we want to describe that, and we probably don't have the time in this podcast to delve too deeply into the phenomenon of nationalism itself, but how does the Kyrgyz nation imagine itself, or how do discourses of Kyrgyz national identity connect with the physical environment of Kyrgyzstan and the resources that are contained therein? And this is something that I came across when I was doing my own research in Kyrgyzstan back in 2014. I was particularly interested in the relationship between Kyrgyz national identity and religious traditions. And something that I was coming across over and over and over, particularly in discussions of what's known as Kyrgyzchilik or Kyrgyzness, was that what it means to be a Kyrgyz is really quite closely linked to the natural environment of Kyrgyzstan. And Askar Akayev in his book Kyrgyz Statehood and the National Epos Manas, this rather famous sort of piece of nationalist literature, says, and we quote this in our report, "The most valuable legacy of the Kyrgyz people is the sacred land of Alato, which we received from our ancestors. Our ancestors left to present and future generations the wholesomeness and royalty of these fine mountains, the Lake of Sakul, a magnificent pearl that has no equal in the world today, fertile valleys and sparkling mountain streams and rivers. On this ancient land in the 20th century, the Kyrgyz people created their own national state." Now, obviously, that description sort of occludes the whole border delimitation process that occurred earlier in the 20th century and exactly how that national state came to be. But once sort of the political territorial unit of modern day Kyrgyzstan comes into being, and this of course gets linked with ideas about national identity and how people who profess to be part of that nation are connected to this particular political territorial unit, the land itself becomes sacralized, and the idea of Kyrgyzchuluk is extraordinarily connected with mazars, these holy sites within Kyrgyzstan. I recall asking a manashi, one of these professional reciters of the Manas epic, if Kyrgyzchuluk would have any particular meaning for somebody who either wasn't from Kyrgyzstan or a Kyrgyz person perhaps who was living in the United States. And he looked at me a bit quizzically and said, no, you know, it's really got to do with people's connection to this actual environment in this country, the real connection to the land itself. And so we see that the natural environment and the resources, however we want to define those, and maybe I'll leave that to Beryl to go into that a little bit more. But the natural environment and these resources are something that is seen as integral to what it means to be Kyrgyz. And there's a sense of sort of emotional and maybe even ideological ownership that transcends the idea of resource nationalism simply in neoliberal terms as, you know, making sure that the state controls particular natural resources for the purposes of selling them on the world market.
Okay, thank you. And that does bring me to you, Beryl. You know, and certainly Kyrgyzstan has this kind of tradition since independence. You don't see these kind of protests at mining sites in neighboring Central Asian states at all. But we have seen them several times in Kyrgyzstan in the last 20, 30 years. So can you please add to what Vincent said? And also, I'm kind of curious about the second part of the title of your report, too, about the slow violence. Can you comment on that a little bit?
Hi, Bruce. It's great to be back. Thanks for having us. Let me try to sort my ideas. Vincent did already a great introduction. I'll try to pick the threads. Yeah, violence. Maybe just a step back, actually, on how we got on working together on this project, which might explain my motivation or our motivation a little better, and then the message we want to convey. The report comes out of a collaborative work that was facilitated by OXO Society for Central Asian Affairs in collaboration with United States Institute for Peace, that had the title of Nationalism and Violence in Central Asia. So with no prior intention to work together on a written project, Vincent and I participated in it, but I already had a hidden agenda, to be honest, because I have been observing quite since some time in policy and scholarly circles in connection to Central Asia that when we talk about nationalism and when we talk about violence, we don't talk about these concepts or phenomena in connection to the natural environment, nature, and what becomes out of it through commodification, as we know, as resources. But there is a lot of national authoritarianism, populist politics, and eventually violence and repression associated or through and by resources, or how we manage and govern resources. This is something that's been more widely spoken about and looked into in different parts of the world. But in Central Asia, we have been much more obsessed with extremism, you know, role of religion and borders when it comes to nationalism, violence and instability. So, but I don't have to tell this to you. You have been there from the very beginning, right? The first toxic spill in 98 that was associated with the Kumtor gold mine. We have been observing a lot of violence in connection with nature and resources. And of course, here I'm only talking about the independence era, because there's also a lot of violence in the Soviet era as well. But what we have seen is, in the name of development and in the name of, you know, for the people, for the nation, nature has been transformed into resources. So at the first instant, we have been seeing a lot of violence against the nature, you know, against glaciers in this case. But since then, there has been a spillover of this very visible violence into different areas of life, and encroaching on different meanings that are associated with nature, because, you know, there is not one nature. It means different things to different people. And this has been progressing, evolving, unfolding since '90s. And as he said, and has been then accompanied by a loud protest, right? And we speak about some of the violence, some of the issues that have been related to the Kumtor gold mine, or generally mining in Kyrgyzstan. But there's so much more that we don't speak about, because we don't see, or we don't want to see it in the first place. And that brings me to the notion of slow violence, that here we are borrowing inspiration from Rob Nixon and his work on slow violence and environmentalism of the poor from 2011, that encourages us to also look at different kinds of violence that are, neither connected to spectacle nor instantly or immediately visible, but that are still there, and they take their toll in different forms and different speeds, so to say, and in most cases out of sight. And we talk about some of these manifestations of violence that go beyond what is readily visible, such as dispossession, in case of, that started with Kumtor, dispossession of glaciers, but in other cases, this is, land or productive land or other resources that then goes on with denial, denial with every new gold mine site that was planned, that was executed or not executed, it doesn't matter really, but denial of people's basic rights and their human rights or their constitutional rights to freedom of expression, or just right to participation and information. What kind of project is cropping up in front of their doorstep, and what's gonna happen with their lives? And then, of course, as protests became louder and louder, that the violence also started to unfortunately change its shape, and it became more and more invisible and insidious. And that I would say that is the moment where we see a change in resource nationalism, at least in Kyrgyz context, that discursively a lot of the grievances and people's concerns that motivated protests were actually mobilized around 2012-13 by Japarov himself to build a case for resource nationalism, saying that the nation demands a different kind of mine management, or the mine that belongs to the nation. And fast forward 10 years later, eventually last year, actually, the case was, executed in Japarov's term, maybe successfully, the Kumtor mine now belongs actually to the government. But it doesn't mean that the concerns that motivated the protest had, a sense of, in terms of property rights, that the mine should belong to state. They were very diverse. We have to also stress that at this point. But by using and co-opting these concerns, the case of nationalization was made. But unfortunately, renationalization of mind has so far not translated into actually taking over responsibility. And this was what we have seen also in the case where there was a crack in one of the pit walls at the Kumtor mine site. And Japarov's reaction to that was very telling, as he said that, disasters will continue to happen. When and what day happened, only God knows. So then we again saw a discursive chain. What happened is that mine is now nationalized. Just to use only one case, really, there are many others. But I'm really skeptical of owning responsibility. That probably will not come. Well, so far we are not observing owning responsibility when it comes to how we speak about what nature might mean to different people and how to deal with resources in a way that is also democratic and inclusive. And this is something I would like to come back, but I think I will leave it at that for the moment.
Yeah, thank you, because I do want to get to Chaparov specifically, but first I want to set the whole table here. So Vincent, I'll go back to you. I mean, you know, you gave us the quote from Akayev. There's been several presidents in Kyrgyzstan. You know, so if you can kind of walk us through how different administrations have looked at this, but what I'm also very curious about with in terms of resource nationalism is what role foreign companies played. They seem to be like the whipping boy, right? We're going to end up with Japarov here in the nationalization, but Kyrgyzstan, you know, we had Cameco at first and Centerra at Kumtormund. We have a lot of Chinese companies that are mining in Kyrgyzstan also, you know, and what does that say about the nationalism part, you know, where this is the wealth of the Kyrgyz people?
Yeah, well, I think there's definitely a sense that foreign actors are profiting much more than the actual Kyrgyz people who, you know, at least in theory, quote unquote, own those resources, that a lot of the profits are being funneled out of the country for the benefit of foreign shareholders. And this touches a little bit on something I did want to bring up, which is in peace and conflict studies, there is this distinction between what's known as positive peace and negative peace. And negative peace is really just the absence of sort of open conflict. And this doesn't necessarily preclude some of the things that Beryl was discussing in terms of despoiling the environment and dispossessing people of their livelihoods and their health. Positive peace, on the other hand, is really about building a more inclusive, just society in which everyone benefits. And I think what we really see, at least from the state-centric discourses about the control and the use of these resources is much more falling down on the side of negative peace, right? That the resources by and large aren't really being used to benefit everybody. The environment itself is in many cases, as Beryl pointed out, being despoiled. And this also kind of ties in with this idea that there are really different meanings regarding the environment and what it means. And I'm hesitant to say that these meanings are necessarily one is right and one is wrong, but the state and the actors who are involved in sort of turning these resources into saleable commodities see the resources as something marketable, whereas in other discourses about the environment, such as the ones that I highlighted in my remarks a moment ago, the environment is seen as something quite integral to Kyrgyz statehood, to Kyrgyz identity, and therefore in some ways, you know, poisoning a river or destroying a glacier is in some ways an attack on the meaning of Kyrgyz identity itself, or you know, at least something fundamental about being Kyrgyz, this connection to the environment. And so what we begin to see there is that we have these two contending resource nationalisms in a way, right? You have those who are interested in exploiting the environment for economic, at least putatively economic, benefit for the whole country, and you have those who see the environment as being something that's bound up with who they are and how they see themselves as a national community. And I don't think that these are necessarily discourses that are easily reconciled. And I think that's where we start to see some of this conflict emerging between these two different groups. And I hesitate to say that there's only two groups. I'm sure there are many others. We obviously in our work really only focused on kind of those two broad spheres. Regarding your question about different administrations and how it's changed, I feel that in a lot of ways, even down to today, a lot of the ideological content of Kyrgyz nationalism was really set during the Akayev era, and you know it's morphed in one way or another over time. But I think that a lot of the sort of vocabulary for understanding Kyrgyz nationhood was sort of laid down. The groundwork was laid down in the 1990s and has in many respects continued to this day. Regarding differing views over how to use, you know, resources like gold and Kumtor, it's my sense at least, and perhaps Beryl can weigh in on this as well, and correct me if I misspeak, but I really feel that, you know, from the state's perspective, profiting off of these resources has largely been the primary goal, and the foreign ownership of these resources has largely provided sort of a rhetorical foil in order to secure greater control over them.
Thank you, Vincent. Beryl, you want to comment on that?
I do. There are, again, so many points I need to decide, but I think that weaves in nicely with your first question on slow violence. It is such a big and so little covered topic that there are a lot of aspects to unpack there. I think, yeah, so one thing about the administrations, I would say that it has been part of nation making. So you know, with that nationalism through resources, you know, in different intensities, of course. And I think we have seen, you know, the deepening nationalism, national populist politics through Bakiyev, of course, and its stronger connection to gold, I think, really from 2010s, 2011-12 on. And unfortunately, last decade has witnessed It's a great intensification and speaking to also global trends, because this is not something unique to Kyrgyzstan, unfortunately, right? And connection to that, it is also a main motivation. I mean, for me, that to speak about these things and to contribute to this report, because when we within the Central Asian context, when we talk about violence, you know, we don't talk enough about state violence, and resource nationalism in that connection much less. And when we think about, you know, resource nationalism, okay, we are more aware of how it has been discursively changed since last decades, but mostly it is still seen as a state wanting to own resources, you know, nationalization of resources, mines, or people protesting for, you know, xenophobic reasons or kicking out the foreign companies. But what I wanted to say now, I'm sorry, I missed my point.
No, that's fine. Because actually there was something, you know, we talked a lot about Kumtor, but I'm interested in some other mines too that are in the country. Chot Gal is one. You know, to get back to the foreign ownership thing, it seems like no matter which administration was in power, at the time, that protests by locals against foreign owned mining companies were something the authorities were willing to go along with for a while. And in fact, in many cases, Kyrgyzstan, or at least the government, ended up getting concessions from the foreign mining companies. Clearly, the Kumtor is the pinnacle of all this, and we're going to get to that in the second half of the show. But do you see that too? I mean, the people show up with legitimate concerns. You know, the Chot Gal thing was a Chinese company, a gold mine that they were doing in Jalalabad province. And the Kyrgyz authorities reacted very meekly to that. They even though protesters beat up the Chinese workers, several of them, burned down some of the buildings at the site, they got away with it. It's almost like the Kyrgyz authorities, I don't know if the Kyrgyz authorities were afraid or if they were actually encouraging this. So what's your feeling about those kind of protests against foreign mining companies? Does that help the government, you know, kind of solidify its nationalist credentials by allowing these things to happen?
I think we have to see see the Kyrgyz state, or just state generally, and the issue you are mentioning here and its connection to resource nationalism as something that is really dynamic. And now I remember something I wanted to say. It is really dynamic in the sense of when we look at resource nationalism or these kind of conflicts or their outbursts at local scale from a development programming point of view or business point of view, it is seen as a risk or threat, first of all, to doing business. You know, it increases the cost of operation, but on the second level, of course, to foreign direct investment attraction. So countries, and Kyrgyzstan also had these phases too, they see a damage to their reputation, to countries' reputation. And you're right in pointing out the cases where mining companies and businesses are left to their devices with communities. And this shows us that there is, first of all, that resource nationalism is way beyond something that has, you know, that is just a risk of doing business. This is, it is much more loaded, but at the same time, it is also really fluid. And it is also at times, you know, it has to be seen within the national border, but because, you know, as you were mentioning, also the foreign companies, it can also be mobilized for transnational resource project and extractions, right? So these lines are, they really coalesce. And in case of how state chooses to react, it really has to be seen within the current problematics, you know, domestic politics and other issues. What I have been studying and observing and even working, because, you know, I actually come from working in such development projects that had also the aim of modernizing, you know, mining sector or attracting more investment, is that it is within the framework of corporate social responsibility that the state really retreats from its own responsibilities. And it is very convenient for it to say, look, you have acquired a license. This is the community and that you have to deal with. And actually, this is, you know, that was the moment of birth for greenwashing or social washing of such project through social license to operate, right? It started emerging, I think it was established around 2012, that the state then says, sort it out yourself. You know, you have to come up with a social package, or you have to sort it out basically what you have to come with. And it is a convenient way of saying we are democratic, we consider local communities' concerns, but it's also a convenient way of, you know, choosing your fights, basically. And there is much more to the backstage of these choreographies, and it is very difficult to get access to decision-making mechanisms of state, depending on investment. But we know that, you know, the case of Kumtor had little to do with the violence against nature or then people through different mechanisms, nor did it had, you know, had it little to do with actually Kumtor being managed by a Canadian company.
Okay, thank you. And we have reached the halfway point in the Measure Lease podcast, so it's time for me to remind that this is the Measure Lease podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. Bruce Pannier, host of the Measure Lease podcast and also the author of the weekly Central Asia in Focus newsletter. We're talking about the recent report from the Oxus Society and resource nationalism, and joining me are the authors of that report, Vincent Hartman, adjunct professor of geography and peace and conflict studies at Wayne State University in Detroit and the University of Delaware. His work has previously focused on Central Asia, specifically on religion, identity, and nationalism in Kyrgyzstan. Buril Ojakli, who leads the research project China, the EU, and Economic Development in Eastern Europe and Eurasia at the Center for East European and International Studies in Berlin. As a critical geographer, she studied infrastructures, resource extractivism, society, nature relations, and authoritarian repression in Central Asia and South Caucasus. Buril also led transdisciplinary development projects on resource governance on behalf of the German government, the EU, and multilateral organizations. Okay, so let's get into the current administration in Kyrgyzstan, because it's already been mentioned that Sadir Japarov, who's the president of the country, was actually one of the people who years ago seemed to be one of these defenders of Kyrgyz rights to its own resources, and one of the loudest voices complaining about environmental degradation at the Kumtor mine. And yet now he is the president, and they've managed to seize total control of the Kumtor mine. There seems like there's been endless scandals practically since then. What happened to 19 tons of gold that they export? Where did that go exactly? Recently, a whole load of gold was found at the border that no one was very anxious to take responsibility for. You know, I'll start with you, Baril. What has Japarov done? I mean, what I mean is his history. I mean, he still is. He's a populist candidate, a populist president, right? In the past, he tried to portray himself as someone who was really kind of defending the people against these evil deals that they had with the Canadian company, corrupt officials in the Kyrgyz government who were helping the Canadian company in this case, and saying that this gold belongs to the Kyrgyz people. There should be a better deal so that all the money that comes from this gold is going to the Kyrgyz people. And they should, there shouldn't be this kind of disregard for environmental consequences at the mines. That was him, as you mentioned, 10 years ago. Who is he now?
Okay, I think I want to add to that because, first of all, actually, we don't know who he is right now because I think he's awfully silent these days. What he has done, I think I started on the right track as you asked the question, what you had in mind. He has done a lot of damage. And one thing I really am very spiteful about is how his contribution in courts to nationalism, populist politics, nationalism and resource nationalism, because what he did in 2012-13, and how that ended is actually a tragedy and maybe an embodiment of really what we are trying to get at here with slow violence. Bruce, your reporting has been very informative. You were there in those years, closely monitoring multiple spills that have happened, and then people trying to get some sort of justice, right? As they have been suffering from implications of the connected to toxicity, and so what happened was that using people's real grievances, he have established a need and he mobilized a mass for needing to own the mine for the nation. And when last year, I think it was end of July, when the wars between Centerra and Kyrgyz government came to an end, made official, Japarov's press secretary announced this as a historical justice. That was a big victory, really. And he used the words for the nation and for mine. And that, hopes of people, Kyrgyz people have come true. And this helps me really illuminate what is meant by slow violence and why slow in front of violence, because it wasn't only enough that people have lost, their livelihoods or will continue to in different mindsets, because Kumtor is just one of these cases. And I keep saying it, but we are really stuck with the more spectacular forms of violence. But what happened was that beyond the physical, beyond the very visibly palpable violence, is that the psychological violence of having to not only having gone through what happened to you, losing your connection to nature, livelihoods, your health, you actually the fact that you had to seek justice through a number of court cases and prove that something happened to you and circumstances that were made extremely difficult and then out of sight, right? Because we don't have the attention or time or whatever to care about these issues that continue to happen. And this is where also the notion of slow violence coming, as one of the cases that Nixon talks about was actually Chernobyl. How it was not enough that people went through, but they actually had to live with the burden, the responsibility of having to actually prove that they went through these struggles. And to add to this and also move beyond Kumtor, and speak about different types of slow violence is cases such as Arlovka. And when I, you know, when I speak about these cases and in our conversations, Bruce, I feel like I am ruminating over and over again the same things. But then I realize I zoom out and I still realize that these topics are, you know, not spectacular enough to be taught more and more. But just to, in a nutshell, talk about another case I have been looking into for many, many years. It's the case of Arlovka that host Taldobulak Levobrezhny gold mine. It is the third biggest gold deposit in the country and actually a Kyrgyz Chinese joint venture. The mine started operating in 2015 and it has gone through different protest periods, but it is called, or it's been referred to since, you know, the community and company reached an agreement as a case of, as a cooperative case, because, you know, people of Arlovka, they have already known mining during Soviet times, and as opposed to other, let's say, militant or resisting cases, mining communities, they have been reflected as cooperative and a good community that fosters the development of the nation. Again, this, you know, the nation for the nation. But what we don't know is what has people of Arlovka still going through since actually saying yes to this mine. They still are actually in different ways resisting how the mine has been operating, how the resources have been governed, and how they have so little information, access to information and space for actually being part of governance. And so what happens is that they are made invisible, basically, because, you know, through praising, even through praising, and that is unfortunately one of the damages that Japarov administration is going with, through praising, you are psychologically pressuring people into silence, basically, and denying their realities, their reasons why they accept the mine in the first place, but the fact that they actually resist, and we don't know about that. So, you know, we also see here a different kind of violence through dispossession, because they are being dispossessed of their voice and representation. If you would look at the statistics, you know, they would not even appear as a case of protest. And that is one of the things I really want to get across, is that this conversation we are having that stands for a deep-rooted problem has to do a lot with the definitions, how we define violence, how we define peace as absence of, you know, overtly visible physical violence, or how, you know, cooperation is a lack of conflict, or how protests, you know, stands for maybe violence. These categories are really problematic, and that is something that really case of Arlovka has shown me, is that we have to be careful about how we define these things. I know it takes time, and that is a bit of the problem, you know, we are facing. We have to be fast in how we report these things, research these things, but compared to the slow cooking, you know, phenomena like violence that don't get attraction, we really feed into problematic things. And then when I say we, it means, you know, the policymakers, researchers, journalists, all of us have a responsibility. I know it takes time, but it also saves lives and traditions and also actually face.
Okay, thank you, Perot. Vincent, but, you know, my question for you is, Now that Japarov has been in power, the same people that he supported, that were calling for more transparency in the mining industry, more of the filter down of, you know, of the funds that came from the sales of gold in this case, but other minerals too, that they've been kind of recast. Japarov's here in now and complaining about that, which is what basically every administration has said. If you're defending the Kyrgyz land, you know, we're absolutely behind you. We support this. But you're kind of seen as like an opposition figure, right? You're against government policy. So when people come out and start saying, where is the money from Kumtor going? You know, I had mentioned what last year there was a big scandal where that people were saying you've exported more than 20 tons of gold in the last year, but you on your balance sheet you don't explain where 19 tons of that gold went, and Japarov said it was a state secret at first. He said we don't really have to tell you, and that the people that were demanding exactly what everyone expected them to and what administrations have supported become the villains. How does that fit with resource nationalism?
I think it fits in to the concept of resource nationalism pretty clearly. If we think of resource nationalism like any other discourse around nationalism, we can see it as a way of defining the national community, who's in and who's out, how, you know, what is the nation, and resources, as I've said, is sort of the idiom through which that is done in this case. And you know, we see this really clearly with this, I guess, now dormant holding company called Heritage of the Great Nomads, right? It doesn't get much more clear than that, this holding company that was supposedly sort of looking after the sort of the mining sector, really quite explicitly defining gold in this case, or other minerals as being sort of the heritage of the Kyrgyz people, and so if we think of resource nationalism in this way, then and it's a very state-centric discourse in this sort of mode, then it becomes very clear why the people who are suddenly sort of questioning the Japarov government, or questioning the state about where the profits are going and what are you doing with this gold and you know, where is it going to, suddenly are sort of positioning themselves against a particular construction of the national community, right? One that is very much, again, in this mode, sort of a state-centric discourse that is very much focused on the resources that are coming out of the earth. So I think it's almost, and it's also a very easy way, right, for a populist government to sort of assert its control or its authority by more or less being able to stand up and say, well, you know, what do you mean? We're the ones who are controlling this. This is for the Kyrgyz people, and are you standing against us? It's, you know, kind of an easy way to delegitimize, I guess, the opposition in a pretty underhanded kind of fashion, if you ask me. But one that I don't think is especially uncommon.
Okay, thanks. Well, we're getting close to the end here, because we've been going for a while. We could say a lot about this, but I'm going to give you each a chance to make a last comment. But also, I know that there were some recommendations that you had at the end of your article or your report about how people inside Kyrgyzstan and people and organizations outside Kyrgyzstan can deal with curbing resource nationalism. So, I'll start with you, Vincent.
I think that as Barilla has already sort of said, it's really important to look more closely into some of these questions about slow violence, looking into questions about what resource nationalism is, and if we are interested in this as a phenomenon that we can that policymakers or activists or others can intervene with, we need to understand that it's not just a sort of univocal phenomenon. There are lots of different contending resource nationalisms, even within a small country like Kyrgyzstan. And you know, if you were to look at Kazakhstan and the role of hydrocarbons, right, you would probably find very, very similar phenomena happening there. So I think it's really quite important from a policymaking, from an activist standpoint, to recognize that sometimes the kinds of rhetoric that is coming out of the state vis-a-vis resources isn't necessarily coming from a position just of trying to secure those resources for the state, but that there's also an ideological dimension here as well that really can't be ignored. And because there's an ideological dimension to it, we have to look past, beyond what just the state or just what state actors are saying about it, and look more closely at what communities themselves have to say about the disposition of resources, who should benefit from them, what those resources or what the natural environment itself
really actually means, because we might get very, very different answers. And I think that the sort of fissure between maybe state-centric discourses and community-centric discourses or different ideas about nationalism, the fissures between those things are where some of this violence or this slow violence is able to sort of metastasize, that this is where it's able to act. And I think that's, you know, for me at least, that coming to this project, that was one of the most important things that I was interested in trying to get at is how do different understandings of what the Earth's natural environment means vis-a-vis nationalism and identity, what do these different things mean, and how can they contribute to or perhaps potentially diffuse conflicts within or between societies.
Okay, thank you, Vincent. Beryl, last word goes to you.
Bruce, thank you. I'll try to speak less gibberish this time. You mentioned one very important thing when last year we again, you know, lost some part of gold, and there were inconsistencies in accounting. He mentioned that, yeah, well, we cannot really, you know, disclose the details about how much gold is transported to where. You know, it's for state security reasons. I think this is really exemplifies, it's one of the great examples of what we have been talking about, because this is also, you know, an extension of resource nationalism, but also helps me make the point of, you know, why this, all of this, you know, of nationalism of and through resources and violence has a lot to do with democracy. When we look at the current programming, development programming, to go back to, you know, why we had this workshop in the first place with Oxus and ISIP, and we have this report series. When you look at it, violence, democracy, human rights, extremism, you know, these issues, they are to an extent sometimes connected amongst each other. But when it comes to environment, you know, we almost either we talk about cross-border transboundary resource management or climate and ecological resilience. But the elephant in the room of, you know, all these extractive nature transformative projects, that how we manage these projects in a very secretive way, that this is also related to human rights and environment and democracy and violence. You know, we don't talk about these things. So we have to go beyond silo programming and also get a little bit over, extremism. I understand it's a very important issue for the region, but there's also a lot of violence coming from the state. And we don't have to, you know, pick our fights all the time. We just have to be really receptive to different types of violence happening. With that, you know, the issue of definition I mentioned, this is something very important. And with that, it is also important that development initiatives, policymakers, that they do not reproduce problematic state discourses. This is something that I have committed myself to fight against. Is, you know, one thing that when people protest in Kurdistan or in Central Asia, they are labeled, you know, mobs for hire or they are just loud, opportunistic protesters. And there is a tendency to reproduce easily these discourses, and we have to pass beyond that. And we also do not need to reinvent the wheel, really, because there are a lot of affected communities that connect to different networks of activists. And there's a lot of work going on, and also scholars. And so it is important to connect to activists' matter of concerns, to really make a contribution to help minimize violence. I think I will stop at that.
Okay, thank you very much. And we've come to the end of the show. Again, there's a lot more we can say about this, and I'm sure we'll all get together and speak about it again in the future. The issue is certainly not going away anytime soon. And of course, to the audience, you can find that the report on resource nationalism and slow violence in Kyrgyzstan at the Oxus Society's website. So I'd like to thank my guests today, Beryl and Vincent. I appreciate you being on the show. And a big thank you, as always, to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mejlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mejlis podcast or the Central Asia in Focus newsletter by visiting RFARL's website at rfarl.org. Thanks, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.